Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Waterville and Colby College for a talk by Paul Steiger, Editor-in-Chief, President, and Chief Executive of ProPublica, an independent, nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. Steiger is also the chairman of the Committee to Protect Journalists, a nonprofit that works for the rights of journalists worldwide. His talk is entitled, How Newspapers Decline Will Affect Citizens and Democracy. If you enjoy this program and would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is Sandy Mazel, Director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement.
Good evening. A native of New York and a graduate of Yale University with an economics major, Paul Steiger began his journalism career with the Wall Street Journal as a reporter in San Francisco in 1966. But he moved south 2 years later to the Los Angeles Times, beginning what was a 15-year career with that paper, first in Los Angeles, then back to Washington, then in Washington as an economic correspondent, and then back to Los Angeles as the business editor of the LA Times. In 1983, he rejoined the Journal as assistant managing editor and climbed rapidly through the ranks of deputy managing editor to managing editor and eventually managing editor and vice president of the Dow Jones Company, starting as managing editor in 1991 and as vice president in 1992. Under his leadership, Journal reporters and editors won 16 Pulitzer Prizes. Since 2008, Paul has been the president and editor-in-chief of ProPublica, a New York-based nonprofit newsroom focused on investigative journalism, what many of us feel is the model of the way that kind of journalism will be accomplished in the future. In 2005, Steiger was elected chairman of the Committee to Protect Journalists, an independent nonprofit organization that promotes press freedom worldwide by defending the rights of journalists to report the news without fear of reprisal. In that same year, he was honored with the Decade of Excellence Award by the World Leadership Forum in London, and he has won many other journalistic awards as well. Among those are 3 Gerald Loeb Awards and 2 John Hancock Awards for his reporting, 3 prestigious recognitions by leading journalism schools, the schools at Columbia, UCLA, and Missouri. And in November of 2007, the National Press Club's 4th Estate Award for, quote, a lifetime of contributions to American journalism. Not quite yet. He has continued to contribute since that time. Tonight, Paul is going to talk to us on the subject of how newspapers decline will affect citizens and democracy. Please give a big Colby welcome to Paul Steiger.
Thank you so much, Sandy, and good evening. Thank you all for coming. I'm honored to be a visiting Lovejoy journalist, and I'm appalled as a member of the Knight Board of Trustees not to know the history of Mr. Lovejoy, and now I do know, and Eric Newton, entrepreneurship I know full well. I now have seen another example of it, and I will tell him that I now know what Lovejoy stands for. This is a beautiful campus in a beautiful town. It's my first time here, not my first time in Maine, but my first time here. I was born in the Bronx. Sandy said New York, but it was really the Bronx part of New York. And I spent most of my formative years in New England. So it's wonderful to be here as the leaves are turning and before Johnson Pond freezes. I want to talk to you about journalism and more broadly about the way we, all of us in the future, will get our first information about what is happening in places that we care about, both near and far. As I don't need to tell you, There is a revolution that is dramatically disrupting all of that. Like most revolutions, it's viewed as a nightmare by some and as the dawning of paradise by others. And as with most revolutions, both sides are right and both sides are wrong. What I want to do this evening is sketch out where we are in this revolution, where we're likely to go next, what it means for our democracy. I'll also talk some about what this revolution means for those young people who would like to engage in journalism, particularly the kind of journalism that is emerging from this revolution. In other words, will you be able to get a job? As I'm sure you know, the agent of this revolution is the internet. In my years in newspaper journalism, we worried a lot about television. It did not disrupt the business of newspapers. Ad rates continue to go up. Revenues and profits continue to go up. The impact of newspaper journalism continued to go up. We worried about cable, which had the ability to target the kinds of audiences that newspapers were particularly good at reaching, but cable didn't exploit its advantage. When the internet came along, newspaper people thought we could coexist. I remember in 1998 when profits were just rolling in to the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones, much of it from internet startups. And we thought, you know, this is wonderful. Indeed it was for the next couple of years, but what also happened in 1998 was that Google went beta. And I looked up and discovered that most readers of the Wall Street Journal, more readers of the Wall Street Journal were getting their stock quotes from Yahoo Finance than from the Wall Street Journal's stock pages. That was the start of the revolution that has destroyed the business model of large and mid-sized metro newspapers, transformed it from a quasi-monopoly, hugely profitable enterprise with a must-have product for vast swaths of society to an, at best, break-even enterprise with a prospect of progressively shrinking revenues and with a product that is liked but not needed by college graduates over the age of 40 and increasingly bypassed by just about everybody else. That sounds terrible, and to many of my friends in print journalism, it is terrible. But as I suggested a minute ago, there have also been good things coming out of this revolution already, and with more likely to come in the future. So what I'd like to do is a list, first of the bad things, then of the good, and figure out where the balance sheet is. As you know, just by picking up the Boston Globe, which I gather circulates here on campus to a lesser extent than the New York Times, newspapers are shrinking. In some cases, they're closing. Detroit, both papers only print their print version 3 days a week. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer has gone to web only. The Rocky Mountain News, among many other mid-sized papers, has closed altogether. The Tribune Company, which has great newspaper names, LA Times, Chicago Trib, Baltimore Sun, Orlando, Hartford, is operating in bankruptcy. The Miami Herald, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, many other great names are hanging on by their fingernails. Even the New York Times has been losing money for much of this year and had to borrow a big slug of money at loan shark rates from Carlos Slim Atu, the richest man in Mexico. Staffs are also shrinking, particularly in the most expensive areas for journalism, investigative reporting and foreign correspondence. The Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, Newsday, and many others have shut their foreign bureaus altogether. The Washington Post has cut its investigative team in half, and nearly all papers have reduced the amount of time that they're able to give to all of their reporters to dig into areas of potential abuse of power, because they need the reporters to file daily to keep the paper going. In total, between the beginning of last year, so January 2008, and the middle of this one, newspapers have cut nearly 26,000 journalists through buyouts and layoffs. A way to think about that, or one way to think about that, is that that is more than 20 New York Timeses. Take what this means in one small place, a place dear to my heart, Trenton, New Jersey, the state capital, where I got my first paying job in journalism in the summer of 1962 when I was still in college. A few years ago, in this land of Tony Soprano, there were 55 journalists covering the Trenton State House. Now I understand there are about five. What this means is not only is there corruption that won't be reported, it means that corruption that wouldn't have been tried because people would figure they would be caught is now going to be carried out successfully because no one will be watching. Multiply that by 50 states and you have a threat to our political system. That is the bad. Now for the good. One thing is speed. We're getting important news way faster. The first detailed information about this summer's brutal crackdown against dissidents in Iran came not from reporters, not even from Iranian reporters, but from ordinary Iranian citizens. They were tweeting and emailing from the scene of the horror, transmitting pictures, horrendous pictures of people being beaten to death in the streets. Reporters were kept away and had to wait to verify the horrific reports that they were getting secondhand. So speed is one. The second is depth and breadth. Before coming here, I wanted to know, being a rube from the South, whether to bring a parka or an umbrella or both. I could get 10 days worth of weather forecasts, not only for Portland, not only for Augusta, but also for Waterville. I left the parka and umbrella home, and do not disappoint me. Yesterday evening, I wanted to catch up on the Roman Polanski story. How many of you know who Roman Polanski is? Yeah, half of you. That's pretty good. In particular, I wanted to know the details of his statutory rape many years ago of a then 13-year-old girl and why she had forgiven him and was urging his release. But the New York Times, the BBC, even the LA Times, where God help my former paper, this is right in the center of their coverage matrix, all had only cursory explanations. But in less than 5 minutes, I found a robust explanation on the web. Ubiquity. Well, I was born in the Bronx. My father grew up in Brooklyn. And I spent part of the 60s, 70s, and 80s in LA. So I am an obsessive Dodgers fan. I live 3,000 miles away in Manhattan. The web lets me follow every pitch, every stat, every injury report. No matter where in the web-enabled world I go, I've done this from London, I've done it from Hong Kong, This is sick, it's obsessive, but it's convenient. Another kind of ubiquity. Last year, a 20-something self-taught internet genius from Vermont, named Amanda Mickel, mobilized hundreds of Obama campaign workers to supply info for her off-the-bus report on the Huffington Post. Most of the stuff they supplied was totally supportive of the campaign, as you would imagine, from campaign workers. But when candidate Obama, in a moment of fatigue, voiced the opinion that some folks who were losing out in the global economy were clinging to religion and guns for solace, Amanda captured that also from the same network, and we all learned about it, much to Mr. Obama's embarrassment. No reporters reported it because they were not allowed in the area where Mr. Obama spoke. Amanda now works for ProPublica, I'm happy to say, and she's put together a team of more than 2,000 volunteers around the country who will do similar reporting for us because they can go where reporters cannot. Opinion. The rise of the web has unleashed a torrent of opinion, perhaps more intense than at any time relative to our population, except in the years leading up to the Civil War and perhaps at the time of the Revolution. Some of it is a mixed blessing. People are riffing in their pajamas about news they wouldn't know about but for the reporting of traditional media, and giving it an often angry, often exaggerated spin to fit their particular vision of the world. But some of it is of real value, finding connections that no one else has spotted, or keeping the heat on, as Josh Marshall of Talking Points Memo. How many of you know about Josh and Talking Points Memo? Fewer. As Josh famously did 2 years ago with the story about politically motivated firings of U.S. attorneys. I mean, this story broke in the general media, but the general media sort of let it go. Josh just pounded away and kept finding new damaging information that gave the lie to the notion that Karl Rove wasn't involved and that this wasn't politically motivated, when of course it was. With examples like all of these, some prophets of web paradise argue that in the future there will be no need, not only for newspapers, there will be no need for organizations of trained professional journalists. If you can get all this on the web, what good are journalists? They make this argument even when faced with examples of egregious errors propagated on the web. As my friend Michael Massing wrote recently in a terrific, if you haven't read it and you're interested in this topic, it's a great analysis of what's going on. Michael wrote in the New York Review of Books, and he noted that during last year's presidential campaign, bloggers on the left insisted that Sarah Palin had faked being pregnant to shield her daughter, Bristol, supposedly the baby's real mother, while those on the right steadfastly asserted that Mr. Obama had faked his birth certificate. I'm pretty confident that both of those assertions were wrong, and yet I read them day after day after day on the web. Still, the prophets of web paradise say, you know, what's the harm? Just as Wikipedia gradually gets us to truth, people with better knowledge will come forward to amend the phony posts like these. And if the process of getting to truth needs to be speeded up, technology combined with citizen volunteers will provide the answer. I don't think so. At my not-so-tender age of 67, I become a committed believer in the ability of the internet to vastly enhance the finding and communicating of what we used to call news. But the process still requires journalism and journalists to smoke out the most difficult to report situations, to test glib assertions against the facts, and to probe for the carefully constructed hoax. It may not require newspapers, at least not as we have known them, as 7 days a week, ink on paper compendiums of new information on a broad range of subjects, department stores of news. But the following example, I think, helps show why our world still will need journalists. And please forgive me, because I'm about to brag on two of my reporters, Charlie Ornstein and Tracy Weber, both Pulitzer Prize winners. On July 12th, a Sunday, the Los Angeles Times published on its front page an article that resulted from months of work by Charlie and Tracy. The story demonstrated in absolutely irrefutable detail that the California board that licenses nurses was horribly falling down on the job. Specifically, the board was taking an average of 3.5 years and as much as 6 years to remove the licenses of nurses convicted of stealing drugs from their patients, you know, replacing the drugs with saline solution and enjoying a high while the patients were in agony, physically beating up their patients, being passed out on drugs or alcohol when their patients faced emergencies. When these nurses were fired from their hospital jobs, they simply took their license down the street to another hospital, often to begin a new cycle of patient endangering misbehavior. In some cases, they could do this for 6 years, and nothing ever happened to take their license away. The next day, story appeared on Sunday. On Monday, the governor fired a majority of the board, all of the members where it was his right to do so. The day after that, the executive director, who had repeatedly denied that there was any problem, resigned and was soon replaced by the new board. Now, it's easy to see why I'm proud of this story, at least I hope it is. Our reporters did exactly what they were supposed to do, uncovered a significant abuse of power, and the governor responded quickly. It's not over, by the way. Replacing the board and the executive director is a good first step, but how well will the new board and the new staff operate? We're going to watch that closely. But why, you may ask, does this case show why journalism organization, journalistic skills are important? The answer is, quite simply, there is no way that a report like this could have emerged on the web without the existence of trained journalists and a news organization to support them. Three reasons. First, it took many months to assemble the databases that would provide preliminary proof of how long it was taking the board to process these cases. Very few bloggers have the time or the capacity to pursue something for that length of time. Second, reporters every day risked being sued for libel or slander. If they misidentified any of the miscreant nurses or mischaracterized their illegal behavior, few bloggers can afford to lose a $10 million libel judgment. Few bloggers, in fact, can fight a lawsuit of that size. Third, scores of people needed to be tracked down and asked if they had any comment or information contrary to what our reporting appeared to uncover. Without that, there's no way the story would have had the credibility that would allow the governor to take his step as quickly as he had taken. for decades, newspapers and to a lesser extent network TV and magazines have provided the kind of reporting, editing, legal guidance, and training necessary for news as crucial as this to get to the public. Some of those entities will morph into more web-friendly form and carry on in the new era as department stores of news. The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post seem likely candidates, although hardly a sure thing. Others, perhaps a Huffington Post, a Talking Points Memo, a Daily Beast, will emerge on the web to take such a role. NPR is another possibility. Its audience is growing, and it's producing both text and video for its rapidly growing website. There's a kind of a convergence between radio, video, and text that's being enabled by the web. But I also think that a larger proportion of journalists will emerge in what one might call boutiques or category killers of news. Category killers like Staples or Toys R Us. Think smaller than a department store, so not requiring as large an initial investment, but big enough to be noticed and relied upon. The website Politico, how many of you have encountered it? That's pretty good, more than half of you. The website Politico might fit that model. So would American Public Media, which operates Minnesota Public Radio, obviously in Minnesota, and Marketplace in Los Angeles and other public interest information businesses. Already, there are proliferating signposts for what this new landscape could look like. The boutiques include hyperlocal websites like Voice of San Diego or MinnPost or dozens more. There are new potential category killers like the revived Center for Investigative Reporting, a nonprofit based at Berkeley that's now refocused itself primarily on California, and something called the Texas Tribune, which a venture capitalist named John Thornton is starting. It's a for-profit model aimed at news affecting the entire state of Texas. Place entities like these and other mutations of them into the proliferating blogosphere, and one has a rich, diverse menu of sources for news, including so-called important news, some nonprofit, some marginally profitable, some potentially very profitable. One also does not have to have domination by a phalanx of large, very profitable, multi-city, national, or global media companies. That's both good and bad. The good is obvious, diversity. The more voices, in some ways, the better. The bad is lack of security. In my 40-year career in print journalism, I worked at two large, then very profitable and very public-spirited newspapers, the LA Times and the Wall Street Journal. I sometimes worried I would get fired if I didn't make the deadline, but I never worried that I would get fired because the paper had run out of money. To those of you interested in a journalistic career, I would say this. The opportunities are great. You can help shape the new reality. That's the positive flip side. When things are collapsing around you, you can pick up the pieces and put them in an order that suits you. But you need to be entrepreneurial. The site one might work for today may be out of business next year or may change into something less congenial. Instead of despairing, you need to maintain a network that with or without Facebook, that helps you spot where the next opportunity may come from. One of my daughters is a film editor in Hollywood, And this is exactly what her career has been like. She has never had a job, but she's worked on probably a dozen movies. And what happens is, you know, the job is over when they turn off the phones, and you lose your parking space, and then you get on your network and you find the next job. She loves the career. She makes, reasonable money. But she's not sure where she's going to be, where she's going to be working a year from now, or certainly 2 years from now. That isn't totally relaxing for people who like security. It doesn't promise to be easy. It does promise to be exciting and psychically rewarding. It can be frustrating when a celebrity blog like Paris Hilton — how many know Paris Hilton? You're lying. You all know Paris Hilton. When a celebrity blog like Paris Hilton gobbles up so much traffic with a photo of Britney, Paris, or Lindsay without underwear. But those sites won't change the world. If you grab hold of a story like Charlie's and Tracy's and refuse to let go, you can. So I hope at least some of you think about a career in journalism, and I hope others of you read journalism with more enthusiasm. I thank you very much for listening to me, and if there's time and the rules allow, I would be delighted to respond to questions. Thank you very much. Over here.
Should I stand or?
Sure. Stand and identify
Hello.
Yourself.
My name is Dokayla Uziri, and I wanted to ask — I came in a little bit late, so I'm not sure, but right when you came, started talking. I was curious to know, could internet — I know New York Times also has, they post their articles online, the same ones that are printed on the newspapers. Is that still profitable, or, what is the difference in profit from, a newspaper than, in the news, on the internet?
Very good question. Did people hear the question? Yeah. The New York Times has an immensely successful website, enormous traffic, and not only does it publish on the web essentially everything it publishes in print, it publishes tons more that it doesn't have room for in print. So it's a wonderful source of news. The challenge is that even as the website has grown rapidly, ad rates on the web have gone down for a variety of reasons. One is that there's so much available content to put your ad on. You know, the bloggers who are blogging for free, as well as the many news sites that are up there, that advertisers can be pushed by Google and other search engines into more and more different places, and so therefore it's tougher to charge a high rate for your ads. So as a result, the New York Times is still, with all the hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone into development and conception and expansion of this website and the value of the content that's put on it, the New York Times is still making way more than, well over 80% of its revenue from print. And a key question is when, if ever, those lines will cross. Everybody thought for years that it was only a matter of time. Now people aren't so sure. So that is the challenge. If you're the place where you're making most of your money, print, shrinks, and you're not getting a countervailing explosion of revenue on the website, what do you do? And I think when one hopes they're able to to sustain both. But it's a real challenge, and it's why their stock price has gone down and why they had to pay such a high interest rate to borrow that money. Yes, because the web revenue is not growing nearly as rapidly as it has to. I thought I saw a hand here tentatively. No? Or does somebody have a microphone? I'm sorry.
Hi, my name's Emily Tenick. I'm from Minnesota. And I was just wondering, how do you think like weekly magazines like Newsweek fit into this issue?
I think weekly magazines are challenged. If you look at Newsweek and Time, they are really skinny because there's very little advertising in them. Now, that's partly because of the recession. But I think that with daily newspapers going into the space that news magazines used to occupy, that of pulling together stuff, filling in the holes of your knowledge, giving you narratives that put you behind the scenes of major news events, giving you reviews of, you know, art and music and movies and so on. That's been taken over by the dailies in print and by these category killer websites. And so the challenge is huge for the news magazines to try to develop a model that works. Now, what Time and Newsweek would like to be is The Economist. Economist is still relatively thick. It has a great audience, a great demographic. I think it's still making money, but its image is, you know, a bit hoity-toity and nasally British. Whereas, you know, we've all known Time and Newsweek forever. We know what they are, and it's hard for them to fool us that there's something else. So both of those magazines are you know, they've got smart editors. They're trying really hard, but it's a challenge. Or does somebody else have, you have a microphone? Okay. Now I'm figuring this out.
Daniel Echt, this is kind of tailing off the question that was over here. But do you think that newspapers putting their content online for free, is that self-defeating?
You know, I think that if newspapers could invent a time machine, they would go back into the 90s and 1998 in particular, when Google was just two guys in a garage, and say, guys, this is great. This is a wonderful thing you've got. I love it. And here's the price. And it would be, you know, a small price because we want you to grow. But as you grow, we'll grow with you. But now that the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's tougher. I mean, my old friends at the Wall Street Journal, you know, from the beginning said content has value. We're not going to give it away. Give us $99 and you can have all of our content on the web. And that has initially was scorned, but it's worked out pretty well. The Financial Times does something similar. I think that the New York Times, the Washington Post, some others are looking hard at how they can turn things around and charge for content. It's very challenging because you risk reducing your traffic, which could cut off advertising opportunities, although none of these guys are selling out their advertising opportunities right now, so it may not be as big a risk as it was when the economy was doing better. So I think that they're considering it seriously, and it may help. It's not a gold mine. I mean, even if they all succeeded in charging, there would still be financial problems moving from print to the web, but it would help. You've got the mic.
What do you think about like the rights of the press under the First Amendment, and now with the emergence of things like bloggers, which could, you know, in some cases be argued as news outlets? How will they fit into the, you know, the First Amendment and the protection of the freedom of the press?
You got to give me a couple more sentences. I'm not sure what you're talking about.
And that will people like bloggers?
Yeah.
Will they have the same protection as like traditional newspapers in their, and what has, you know, like shield laws and things like that and freedom of the press?
It depends on what you're talking about. They have the same freedom of speech rights. As Sandy mentioned, my other day job is as chair of the Committee to Protect Journalists, where we try to keep journalists out of jail or from getting beaten up or killed around the world. And this year, for the first time, there are more bloggers than any other kind of journalist in jail around the world. Bloggers are 40-something percent. Print journalists are like 30%. Print journalists used to dominate this, and the rest is broadcast. But in the U.S., if you're a blogger, you have the same freedom of speech rights that a journalist does. If you want to seek protection under various state shield laws, there are shield laws in many but not all states, and there's as yet no federal shield law. Different states have different definitions of what is covered by these shield laws, and many would not protect bloggers unless a majority of their income was from blogging. Others are more expansive, so it varies. But I think over time that that bloggers for whom it's a serious activity will get the ability to have copyright protection.
Adam, hi, I'm Adam Thompson. I was wondering, and you alluded to this just a minute ago, but I was wondering if you could explain a little more what your organization is doing, maybe give some examples as to what your organization is doing to protect journalistic freedom internationally and in the United States.
Sure. The Committee to Protect Journalists was founded 29 years ago by some American foreign correspondents. The same Michael Massing, who I mentioned before, was key among them. And they enlisted Walter Cronkite to lend his name to the effort. And Walter's name was magic and enabled them to get their early money to get out of the gate. And the idea was, we here in America benefit from the First Amendment. You go around the world, and journalists are routinely thrown into jail, beaten, get not only financial penalties but jail criminal penalties for, you know, so-called libel. In Russia, since Putin came to power, there have been 18 journalists murdered execution style, and only one case has been successfully prosecuted. So there's over the last 2 years, something like 100 journalists were killed around the world. 70% of them were not caught in a crossfire. They were deliberately murdered. So there's a lot to do. And the way we do it is, first of all, there's a great staff, plus a board of 35 people, with much bigger names than mine. Brian Williams, Diane Sawyer, Christine Amanpour, folks from all the major papers, and what we basically do is raise money for the staff to go around the world and try to get a hot spotlight shown on places like Russia, like Iran, like Venezuela, like Cuba, like China, where and, you know, numerous smaller countries where journalists are abused for pursuing their craft. And in addition, members of the board go on missions. I mean, I've been to Moscow. I've been to Beijing. I've been to Riyadh, you know, on behalf of CPJ, and other folks have been to Baghdad and Kabul and to Islamabad. And the idea is to use what we have, which is the power of publicity, to try to get people to behave. And in some places, we're successful. One example is the Philippines, which was, for a while, the most murderous place for journalists in the world per capita. And we did a report saying that. First, the government denied it. Then we showed them the data, and they actually took steps to try to prosecute some of those cases. So it's a crucial fight, one that is moving to the web, and one that we're looking for support anywhere we can find it.
Wondering, there's been some discussion about moving towards an NPR type of model for print journalism, with like foundation money and corporate grants going towards like print journalism and newspapers. Do you think that that's actually a sustainable type of model, or do you think we shouldn't even expect to see a newspaper in 10, 20 years?
There are really sort of two questions there. I mean, I think that there will be some print newspapers in 10 or 20 years, but they'll be very different. The web is so efficient at delivering news and information that it's going to be increasingly the vehicle. But the model that you're talking about, this sort of NPR-style model of a mixture of nonprofit funding and, you know, advertising revenues or subscriber revenues or a combination of those things, those models are being tried even as we speak. And I think some mix of those will work in various arenas. I think the government piece is tough. You know, I mean, a lot of my colleagues look wistfully at Britain, you know, where they have this tax on everybody who owns a TV set pays the tax, and that supports the BBC. And they have the little trucks wandering around the streets testing to see if there's anybody with a TV set who hasn't paid his tax. Well, if you had a tax like that in the U.S., it would be billions of dollars, with our much greater population. I don't think that's going to happen here. There may be some local communities that would support a news organization like this, and there may be some kind of tax preference. For years, news organizations, particularly magazines, but newspapers also, benefited from second-class postage rates. Now it's much more efficient for newspapers, at least, to deliver themselves. But when the post office was delivering, those rates were really valuable. Well, some people think that there might be some kind of tax benefit that would help newspapers in a non, the importance would to would be sure that it was non-political. But all kinds of mixed models of the sort you're suggesting are being tried right now.
You talked about the number of times that ProPublica is sharing its product with major national newspapers, USA Today. You talked about a dinner, the LA Times you talked about just now. What is your outreach? When you put a story just on the website, how many hits are you getting? How many subscribers do you have? And, you know, it's obviously important to you that your stories get out. How important is it that it gets out on a major news outlet as opposed to just the internet?
It's very important. I mean, our goal is to get our stories in the place, not necessarily where they get the biggest audience, but the audience that is most likely to be responsive to what we discover. And, you know, not all of our partners will tell us what kind of traffic our stuff generates on their site. But typically, it will still generate 20 times as much on an existing platform site as on ours. So it behooves us to partner with the right platform. I mean, we recently, and this is an extreme case, we recently had a big story with a partner. And on our website, the story had something like, I don't know, 45, 50,000 hits, which is a lot for one story for us. On the partner site, it had over a million hits. So, you know, so the leverage of existing platforms is still great. We expect our website to grow, and it's grown every day since we launched it, and to become increasingly important over time. But in the intermediate term, the big media platforms still have a lot of reach, and they're very important to our mission. Well, listen, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed your questions, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Paul Steiger and his talk, How Newspapers Decline Will Affect Citizens and Democracy, on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of this Speaking in Maine program, or enjoyed it and would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting mpbn.net, and clicking on Audio On Demand under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen. There you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.